This is the iGUIDE Korea Podcast, Episode 2.
Get amped, get stoked, get ready to play. This is the iGUIDE Korea Podcast, your source for adventure and thrills in Korea's rocking outdoors. Come out and play with us.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of the iGUIDE Korea Podcast. I'm Eddie Park, and this podcast is here to take you on a tour of the more extreme side of South Korea. We cover rock climbing, mountain biking, ice climbing, mountaineering, camping, and other awesome outdoor activities, because the world is a playground, so let's go out and play. Let me start with a thank you for those of you who listened to my first ever episode. That was the one on hiking in South Korea. I really appreciate the advice that people have left and the thank yous. Being the first podcast that I had ever done, I was pretty sure there'd be some mistakes I'd make, and the comments that people have left me were very constructive, and I thank you very much again. I'm happy to get that first hurdle behind me, though, and I'm able now to focus on the next episodes, making them much, much better. For those of you who are just joining us, this podcast is part two of a four-part series titled Introducing Korea's Outdoor Adventure. In the last episode, we covered the more popular activity in Korea, which was hiking. In this episode, we cover climbing, as in rock and ice climbing and mountaineering. In part three, which is the next episode, we'll cover biking. And in the last episode of the series, part four, we'll talk about water sports. Well, let's get to the topic at hand, and that's climbing. In this episode, we look at the Korean climbing scene, its history, its present, its future outlooks. I'll suggest some places to climb, and I'll give you the resources you need to start climbing. In terms of global achievements, Koreans have had the most success in climbing. Now, when I say climbing, I'm talking about very technical stuff. I'm talking about rock climbing, ice climbing, and mountaineering. These activities require a deep understanding of ropework and safety measures in order not to fall to one's demise or not to be seriously injured. Now, that may seem to be a bit of a morbid intro to this climbing episode, but that is the reality. With every piece of climbing gear you buy, there comes this little tag, and this little tag has a disclaimer on it. And the disclaimer sounds a little like this. Technical rock climbing is inherently dangerous. Our products are for rock climbing, bouldering, and mountaineering only. Any person using our gear in any manner is personally responsible for learning the proper techniques and good judgment. We strongly recommend that every climber seek instruction by a qualified professional. You are responsible for knowing and respecting our product's capabilities and limitations. Always know the maintenance and use history of your equipment and destroy retired gear to prevent further future use. The use of secondhand equipment is strongly discouraged. You are responsible for your own actions and decisions. Failure to follow these warnings can result in severe injury or death. Ba-ba-ba. Well, that's the disclaimer. That's an actual true disclaimer from the Metolius website, a popular American climbing equipment manufacturer. Now, I'm not trying to scare you off climbing. I'm actually going to tell you how awesome it is in this podcast. But I want to make sure that I don't make any disillusions that technical climbing can be approached in the same manner as, you know, as a pickup basketball game or going down the bunny slopes at a ski hill. It's different. There are serious consequences when you make small mistakes. The American Alpine Club, actually, releases an annual journal called Accidents in North American Mountaineering. The journal analyzes the year's most significant accidents in order to prevent others from making the same mistake. So you're supposed to read it and learn from it. The risk to life and limb is inherently part of the climbing activity, and that risk is what makes climbing so addictive? Yes. Let me explain. A superficial view of this addiction, often, you know, people think about tank top adrenaline junkies taking huge falls. And that may be the most common reason people try to start climbing at first. Getting that adrenaline rush where the anxiety grips your body and your mind and your body's shaking uncontrollably and you grip the rock like a vice and a million thoughts just surge into your head in the blink of an eye. It's a feeling that not everyone might like, but other people really get off on it. But here's the thing. When you're able to overcome that feeling and you're able to control it and accept the rush, that's the awesome thing. That's where you feel like king of the world. Let me describe it in another way. For me, the addiction is not really the main thing, the main reason why I climb anymore. I've been climbing for a while now, I'd say over 17 years. I don't really know how many years. Actually, 20 now. Yeah, 20. But it's part of the experience. It's part of a more meaningful experience. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. For me, climbing has built a sense of self-confidence and self-reliance that I couldn't get anywhere else. When you're hanging from your fingertips and you're stepping tiptoe on dime edges and you're looking at the next hold, that hold seems miles away. And in your mind, you don't know if you can reach that next handhold. And in your mind, you think you're going to fall. And in your mind, you're creating all these weird realities, like what if you fall and you fall backwards and you hit your head? What if you fall and you hit that ledge, you're going to break your ankles? You put all these things in your head. All these things happen in your head. So many things just rush into your mind, keeping you from the next goal, from the next handhold. And that's the adrenaline. The adrenaline's got that fight or flight reaction, and that's a flight reaction that we're talking about. And so basically it's telling you just close your eyes and let go and just give up. That's what can happen when you let the adrenaline take control of you. The awesome thing is when you take control of the adrenaline, and that's the fight option. That's the fight instinct and with adrenaline. And what that does is that with all this superpower you get from the adrenaline, your mind just gets clearer and you start being able to do things that you really did not think you could do. You defy all the fear and self-doubt. And for that moment, there is just the climb, nothing else. And you keep reaching upward and you keep raising your legs and you keep stepping up higher and you keep reaching upwards. And soon you're at the top with the world beneath your feet. It's an unbeatable feeling. And that's the addictive part. And you feel like you can do anything and you can take on anything. Yes, yes. In many cases, you do fall trying. But you fall with your eyes wide open, you know? You're cursing the whole way down. And you want to do it again. For me, some of the climbs I've done have been dramatic productions where I'm so close to getting the crux move but falling at the same spot over and over again. And then there's another whole set of life lessons to be learned from that. Like learn to approach problems without the burden of past failures lurking in your mind. Believing you can do it because no one else can get you up that climb. You know, all that really good, healthy, metaphysical stuff. Climbing is zen. Climbing is great. So despite the inherent dangers in climbing, there are things that climbers get from the experience. And that's the reason why we come back to it. And we learn so much about ourselves and just what we can do. But let's get back to climbing and climbing in Korea. And we're going to take a look at some Korean climbing history. And Korea actually has a very interesting climbing history that most Westerners aren't aware of. For example, did you know the rock climbing shoe company 510 based its early shoe molds on the shape of a Korean's feet? More accurately, one climber named Young Chu. Young Chu in the 70s and 80s was a Yosemite climbing bum. He started making motorcycle bags to make some extra money, and this eventually led to shoemaking. It was around this time when he was into shoes that Charles Cole, the founder of 510, worked out a deal where Young would make the early models for the company's rock climbing shoes. And so he based the lasts or molds on his feet. You know, I've always wondered why 510s out of all the climbing shoes out there had always fit my feet so perfectly. And now I know Young Chu probably has the same wide Korean feet as I do. Anyways, after he stopped working with 510, Young Chu started his own climbing brand called Mad Rock. And that, as many people probably already know, has developed into a successful climbing gear company, offering products from award-winning shoes to hardware like carabiners. And another climbing equipment founder that has ties to Korea is the legendary Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Chouinard Equipment that later became Black Diamond and the founder of the high-end clothing company Patagonia. So Yvonne came to Korea as part of his U.S. Army duties, and he did a tour in Korea for 2 years, from 1962 to 1964, and it was based out of Incheon. Apparently, according to him, he was not so fond of the army life, but he did love the climbing near Seoul, especially in Insubong, where he has established two classic routes called, funny enough, Shwinard A, which is 5'10", and Shwinard B, around 5'8". Those are some interesting bits of climbing history I never knew of until I came to Korea. But let's go back even further to 1926, where on Insubong in Bukhansan National Park, which is near Seoul, a certain Mr. Archer, who was the British vice consul to Korea at the time, and a Korean man named Im Moo, actually the Koreans' participation is unconfirmed, but anyways, some reports say with this man, with this Korean gentleman called Im Moo, they made the first modern rock climbing ascent in Korea. And that was probably the beginning of Europe's large influence on the development of Korean alpinism. However, Korea's global mountaineering history isn't as long as their European counterparts. According to Korean mountaineers, the reason why Koreans didn't start international alpine ascents or mountaineering ascents until much later was because Koreans were restricted from leaving the country during the Japanese colonization, which ended in 1945. And during the Korean War, they couldn't go. And by the time the Korean War had ended, the country was too poor for anyone to leave. However, since then, Korean mountaineers have established new routes of the biggest mountains in the world, including Yongsuk Park's route on the southwest face of Everest, which was called, simply enough, the Korean route. Korea is tied, actually, right now with Italy for having the most climbers summiting all 14 8,000-meter peaks. The five Korean climbers who have completed this extraordinary feat are Yongsuk Park, Hong Gil-eom, Wang Yong-han, Jae-su Kim, Chang-ho Kim, and Chang-ho actually has set the record for the fastest ascent of all 14 8,000-meter peaks. At the beginning, however, Korea's global mountaineering presence was not so successful. It was actually quite fatal. The first attempt on an 8,000-meter Himalayan peak was in 1971 when Chung-sup Kim and his team attempted to climb Manaslu, 8,156 meters. And unfortunately, one member fell to his death on that expedition. In the same year, an expedition to Lhotse-shar, 8,252 meters, by the Korean Alpine Federation, failed due to a snowstorm. And then the next year, Chung-sup Kim's second attempt on Manaslu ended in the death of five team members and nine Sherpas. So after the string of tragedies, the Korean Alpine Club just stopped all Himalayan expeditions. And they decided to send 13 climbers to the French National Climbing and Skiing School in Chamonix for training. And it was good that they did, because this training brought in newer and safer climbing techniques to the country. However, even with the overseas training, Korea's top mountaineers have continued to perish. Mi Young-go, who became one of the first people to climb three 8,000-meter peaks in a single season, had a fatal descent on Nanga Parbat after reaching the summit in 2009. And in 2011, the remarkable Yongsuk Park and his party went missing and are presumed dead during their attempt on a new route on Annapurna. Some say the fatalities are partially because of a tradition of risk-taking among Korean mountaineers, whose passion and determination to get to the top sometimes overshadows proper preparation. But others have also pointed out that other countries have had similar tragedies, and they believe that if you spend enough time in those big mountains that are full of avalanches, that are full of thin ice, falling rocks, sub-zero temperatures, and blinding storms, those mountains will take you for their own. And in my opinion, that's true too. Whatever the reason, though, it's tragic. Primarily, it's tragic for the family and friends. And it's also tragic for the younger generation of mountaineers in Korea who lose these valuable mentors. And I feel it's important to remember and honor the achievements of the past mountaineers and the present as they continue to create a legacy for future generations. So here's a list of some of the more notable accomplishments. As mentioned before, the late Myeong-go was also known as Mi-sun-go. Along with Jesu Kim, they were the first people to summit 3 8,000-meter peaks in a single season. Incredible. Myeong was also an accomplished sport climber, winning medals in international competitions like the X Games. Actually, the first time I ever met her, and the only time I ever met her, unfortunately, was at the X Games in San Diego, where she took silver, I believe, from Katie Brown, just behind Katie Brown. Then there's the late and legendary Young-suk Park. This man is one of the greatest athletes and adventurers that has ever lived. He's the only person in history to accomplish the True Explorer's Grand Slam. And what that entails is all 14 8,000-meter peaks, the seven summits, and both poles, north and south. He has broken records by climbing 6 8,000-meter peaks in 1 year and trekking to the South Pole on a self-sufficient expedition in 44 days. Additionally, if that wasn't enough, he's established the new route on the technical southwest face of Everest. This guy has seriously done it all. And for the newer generation of mountaineers, there's Chang-ho Kim. On May 19th, 2014, he broke the record for completing all 14 8,000-meter peaks without oxygen in the fastest time. 7 years, 10 months, and 6 days. And he's still an active climber today. Then there's Chiyoung An, who's an IGK team member. He's focused on doing first ascents in alpine style. His ambition has produced 2 Golden Ice Axe Asia Awards, or Pilet d'Or Asia. One was for his first ascent of Himjeong, 7,140 meters, which was at the time the highest unclimbed peak in Nepal. And his second Pilet d'Or Asia was for his first ascent on Gashbrum 5, 7,147 meters in 2014. So the future of Korean alpinism continues to look bright as the younger generation continue this new legacy. And where do these fearless explorers train in Korea? Well, you might have noticed that Korea doesn't have the highest mountains out there. So to simulate high altitude, much of the training will happen in the winter at Insubong in Bukhansan National Park. I've mentioned it a few times. And Soraksan National Park. And what's really great about Korea is that because of the topography, you really feel like you're in high altitude when it's winter, because you have all these rocky outcrops and you have these spires and you have these domes. And so it really makes a good low altitude training ground for the high altitude stuff. Now, from the very big mountains to the smaller mountains, well, at least to very steep cliffs, we come to the rock climbing section of this podcast. And like Myeong-go, many of the top mountaineers in Korea have come from a solid rock climbing background, and Korea is a great place to rock climb. What I love about the country is that within a 200-kilometer radius or two-hour drive from my home in Daejeon, the middle of Korea, I can access so many different types of rock, from fine-grained granite to like coarse conglomerate, and I can access about 8 different climbing areas. Korea has so much rock. One rock climbing guidebook for Korea lists 64 separate climbing areas, and many of the areas are very accessible with short hikes to get to the base of a crag. But there are also hidden gems that you have to sweat and make an effort to get to, and I love these hidden crags because they just seem to rise out of nowhere. You're like you're hiking in through the forest and you're on this trail, and all of a sudden you look up and boom, there's this crag. And the best part, there are usually no crowds. And that is something you do have to deal with climbing in Korea, especially at the more popular, easily accessible areas that are close to the city. You have to deal with crowds. So for me, weekdays is popular areas, and weekends are these kind of hidden adventure climbing time. Now, here's a quick rundown of the general geological makeup of the country. Now, this is really brief, okay? So I'm no geologist, but this is the trend. In the northern parts of Korea, you'll find many of your popular granite and multi-pitch climbs. Insubong, where the likes of Chris Sharma, Yvonne Chouinard have climbed, is located near the heart of Seoul, and it's very accessible by subway and bus. Soraksan National Park, which was designated a biosphere preservation district by UNESCO in 1982, is a beautiful place, and it offers a more wilderness experience with stunning summit views that include the East Sea. And the EC is like less than a 15-minute drive from the park entrance. There you can do multi-pitch climbing, ridge climbing. You can do a lot of big, higher stuff. As you travel southward into the center of the country, you'll find more sedimentary formations. The country's main sport climbing venue is Sonnensan National Park. They have a 30-minute approach, and you get a beautiful setting of overhanging limestone routes, which have 5.7s to 5.14s, lots of bolts. Or you can try your hand at Cheongseokgul, which is the first bolted limestone crag, sport crag in Korea. This roadside crag is conveniently located at the end of a parking lot, and the steep 5.12s there are still standards today. Not to be missed are the beautiful seaside crags at the peninsula and neighboring islands. Being a peninsula, Korea has lots of spectacular seaside crags. Be aware, though, the igneous rocks, like at Hagampo Amjang on the west coast of Chungcheongnam-do or South Chungcheong Province, are much more stable than the sedimentary formations like at Amnam in Busan. So make sure the rock you're climbing on has had sufficient time to dry, especially if it's sedimentary rock. With the granite-type rocks, you don't have to worry too much, but definitely wait for low tide and warm, sunny days. That's the way to spend time on the coast anyways, just waiting there, watching the sea, checking things out. And especially if you're on the west coast, you have some awesome sunsets, especially at the previously mentioned Hagampo Amjang. I love climbing there in the summertime. And just like, I'll get there kind of late just so I'm only doing like a couple of routes because there aren't that many there anyways. And then just watch the sunset. It's beautiful. Romantic. Bring your wife, bring your lover, bring somebody. Then there are the islands. One island in particular has gained popularity for quality climbing and beautiful scenery. That is the island of Ulongdo. To get to Ulongdo, it requires about a 3.5-hour rocky ride. Boat ride, so you want to make sure you have sea legs or lots of motion sickness pills. But once you get there, the place is kind of cool. It's like a throwback into a more peaceful, less techie Korea. The place has volcanic cliffs and old undeveloped forests. It's pretty unique for the country. And it's no wonder the climbing here has developed so quickly. Climbers are kind of envisioning this place to be the prime climbing vacation spot in the country. And that's it. There you go. That's a quick geological guide to Korea. You got your northern granite stuff, long, bigger routes. You got your southern sport climbing, sedimentary stuff. And then you got the seaside crags and islands. And now for man-made geology. And I'm talking about climbing gyms. For you plastic-pulling juggernaut gym rats, there are plenty of bouldering gyms in Korea. Actually, you are very hard-pressed to find climbing gyms with roped routes. And that's because the real estate in Korea is at a premium. So most gyms don't have the finances to rent out spaces with ceilings higher than like 4 meters. However, even though the gyms are short here, it hasn't stopped the climbers from pulling hard on longer routes. So what they do to compensate, many of these bouldering gyms will set these monster 40-plus move traverses. And they're hard. You're traversing on like overhanging features the whole time. But if you like going high, there are a few options. There are 3 indoor climbing gyms that do have rope routes. And they are K2 Fitness and Climbing Center, O2 World, and the North Face Dino Wall. Addresses, phone numbers, and websites for these areas are given in the show notes. And you can see these all this kind of information. We have lots of resources that will be in the show notes. But I digress. At the North Face Climbing Wall, Dino Wall, you can bump into the likes of Kim Jae-in or Jae-in Kim. And Jae-in Kim, if you are into the World Cup, has won the lead climbing World Cup 3 times. And she's a world champion once. And she's also won the prestigious Rockmasters. Last time I checked, she still trains there. So that's a really good place to climb to see how world champions train. These places, because they are modern facilities, you should be expecting to pay premium prices. And premium prices aren't really that expensive. I think at O2 World, they have a deal where if there are 2 or more people, the price is 20,000 Korean won per person, which is little less than $20 USD. But if you like free, and I know most people do like free, there are World Cup caliber outdoor climbing walls with free access. Yes, I said free. and most major cities have them. How do they get away with it? Well, they don't have the same legal and insurance issues that we have in North America. Is it safe? That's debatable. But I haven't heard of anyone dying or getting seriously hurt at these free areas. There very well could have been someone that got hurt, but I guarantee you more people are getting injured on real rock than at these climbing walls. I guess the idea is that you just shouldn't be silly. And if you are and you get hurt, then it's your fault for participating in a dangerous sport. Okay, that's a bit harsh, but like I said, climbing is a dangerous sport no matter how tame you try to make it. A buddy of mine used to say, when you climb, there are three partners. You, your Blair, and gravity. And guess what? Gravity's a bitch. Kind of like that. Anyways. Okay, well, here's the deal. Many of these climbing walls are not managed daily. Some are, but many of them aren't. And at many of them, there's a club or manager that comes a couple of times a week to check the bolts or to make new routes and other safety stuff. So because they don't come all the time and there isn't someone there all the time, just, you know, user beware. But you know what? They're awesome. I climb on them, especially at the one that's like 5 minutes from my house. And people often go to these places on summer nights because they're really convenient. For example, at the climbing wall, the outdoor climbing wall at World Cup Stadium in Daejeon, they have these big floodlights. I think they used to do this on Tuesday or Wednesday nights. They have these big floodlights that light up the wall so people could climb at night in the cool summer nights. My city's pretty awesome. But more about my city, Daejeon, in a future podcast. That option is available. But it's kind of funny, though. With so many bouldering gyms in the country, you would think that there would be a relatively high amount of bouldering areas or a big bouldering scene in Korea, right? Nope. Bouldering as a scene in itself is actually fairly undeveloped out here. Many of the Koreans do so much bouldering in the gym that when they get outside, they're just amped to get high on some roped routes. They see bouldering as a means to an end, like practice, which it originally was designed to be. It's also interesting how the country that's full of stunning crags has relatively few bouldering areas. The best concentration of quality boulders is in the Busan area, which is the second largest city in Korea. The expats and locals there have developed several areas, and I'm grateful for these new boulders that have ventured into Korea and established new lines and established new areas. When I first got to the country, I was like one of those bouldering bros who valued his crash pad as much as he valued anything else in his life. I scoured existing climbing areas for boulders and quickly found that to get to proper bouldering, you had to go deep in the mountains. And what you get were these awesome highball boulder problems in these nice secluded valleys. One of my favorite places that I have brought a bouldering pad to or a crash pad to is Soraksan. Excellent place. But when you go, make sure you go during the dry season because some of the smoothest and coolest problems were on boulders that were in seasonal riverbeds. Bouldering is slowly catching on, but you don't get that bohemian vibe that's prevalent in North America. And I guess that's, you know, different culture, different place. So I'll finish the rock climbing section on ridge climbing. And that's because it's a type of climbing that can really be enjoyed in the Korean landscape. Ridge climbing offers a great adventure because not only do you travel vertically, but you also travel horizontally. In ridge climbing, there's usually a combination of steep vertical climbing, rappelling, and hiking. And this country's rocky terrain lends itself to spires connected by climbable peaks. And it's slightly different from North America because you don't have to go to high elevations to do it. Like much of the climbing in Korea, it's quite accessible. So if you're looking for something that's kind of uniquely Korean or at least better enjoyed in Korea, ridge climbing, my personal opinion. For more information on climbing in Korea, check out the only English guidebook called Climb by Dong-il Ryu. Dong-il's work is truly a landmark publication because it has made Korea more accessible to an international group. It's a comprehensive guidebook with useful GPS coordinates and directions to crags using public transportation. If you are climbing in Korea for any length of time, it's a great resource to have and a great souvenir of the country's climbing venues. For those of you who can read Korean, Yonggi Kim has released a series of guidebooks, this new series of guidebooks, depending on the area that you're in. There is a link to all the books in the series in the show notes, so you don't have to write all this stuff down. Yonggi's books are packed with history and route information, and he knows his stuff because he put out the first nationwide guidebooks called Hanguk Amjang Sunre in 2004, And so he's just revamped these books and made them more specific for the areas. As for ridge climbing, there is a guidebook called Rij Dungban, which translates basically to ridge climbing. It covers many ridge climbing routes for the whole country. I got all these books on my bookshelf because they look great. We have the titles in our show notes and links to buying these books. But unfortunately, most of these links are for Korean retailers or Korean online retailers. You can buy directly from us if you like, but we do take a marginal percentage in return for the convenience of us ordering for you and sending it to you. They are super useful guides, and if you're going to be in this country for a while and you want to get climbing, they are the thing to get. So get them. Enough said. With the end of the rock climbing session, let's take a mini break by listening to this improvised advertisement. Do you dream of rock climbing? Do you dream of mountain biking? Do you dream of being rad? If you're a novice or a pro, iGuide Korea can make your Korean outdoor adventure a reality. Visit our webpage at www.iguidekorea.com or email us at igk@iguidekorea.com. Tell us your dreams and we'll take you higher and harder. iGuide Korea. That was my first little mini ad. I was told that I should break this podcast up with these little mini ads. And, well, I thought I'd put my own mini ad in. Hope you guys don't mind too much. Okay, now we are on to cooler things. And for those of you into the colder side of climbing, there is lots of ice climbing in Korea. The steep mountainous regions of the Korean peninsula produces beautiful waterfalls in the summer. And those waterfalls become even more beautiful, spectacular ice falls in the winter. You know, there's nothing quite like hiking into the mountains and coming up on a wall of blue ice that's like just smooth to the touch. And there's nothing around you except for nature, mountains. You know, it's cool. You know, the hustle and bustle of the country is gone and it's just quiet. It's a deep winter, comforting quiet. If you're not into all that hiking in the winter and getting all sweaty and cold, and you're more into like the athletic cragging experience with shorter approach times, then you'll love Korea's ice parks. These are areas that have artificially created ice falls by pumping water over a cliff. And they just leave it there in the winter and have these really nice, cool ice formations. These parks, ice parks, are normally free of charge too. And of course, because they are, they're climb at your own risk. Since these areas are not managed beyond pumping the water at the start of the season, be careful and treat them as you would a natural ice formation. Treat them with caution and experience. Most of the popular ice parks are up north in Gyeonggi-do or Gangwon-do, about an hour north of Seoul in Yangju-gun. Yangju-gun, there's Garabi. And Garabi is one of the oldest ice parks in Korea. Climbers have reported going out there around 1989. It is definitely a very popular destination due to its super ease of access and very close proximity to the big city. And when I say big city, I mean Seoul. Apparently, you can take the subway and bus close to the area, and then you can hike the rest of the way. I've always driven right to the base. At the area, they have 20-meter ice climbs that are well-formed in the winter, and the grades range from WI or Waterfall Ice 3 to Waterfall Ice 4. To keep things interesting and definitely harder, the local climbers have bolted mixed routes around the M5 to M6 range. Then there is Pande near Wonju, which is about an hour and a half to 2 hour drive east of Seoul. It's another super popular ice park, and it's got many more routes than Garabi and much higher routes than Garabi. I think they have one route that's close to 60 meters. For more natural ice falls, so the highest concentration of established routes are in Soraksan National Park. Now, I know I've said Soraksan National Park like a bunch of times because it's the place to go to. It's awesome. This place has the longest ice climb also in Korea, and that's in the form of Tongwangsong Waterfall. Tongwangsong Waterfall. When this thing freezes, it's about a 320-meter ice climb. You can spend a whole week playing in Soraksan National Park, to be honest. There's just so much to do, including like hikes, ice climbs, rock climbs. It's also situated next to the East Sea, so you get fresh seafood. There's plenty of stuff available, and it's just spectacular. But now, don't think ice climbing is all in the north. The south has plenty too. In particular, down in Gyeongbok province, Cheongsok Eulamgol Ice Park. This place plays host to the UIA World Cup. Yes, the World Cup comes to Korea, and they compete here. Oh, and lest I forget, there's also O2 World in Uidong in Seoul. This place is kind of neat. It is home to the tallest indoor ice climbing gym in the world at around 20 meters. They even have a Guinness Book of World Records plaque inside the freezer/gym. I've mentioned this place before for the lead climbing wall because it's one of the few places where you can lead climb. It's in the neighborhood at the bottom of Insubong as well. And I've mentioned Insubong as well too. It's the popular multi-pitch climbing area in Seoul. So this place, O2 World in Uidong in Seoul, that has an indoor ice climbing wall. It also has a lead climbing wall. It's at the bottom of Insubong, which is Insubong, the most historical kind of tester metal rock climbing multi-pitch area in the country. This whole neighborhood is pretty neat. And they've got shops and restaurants, so it's definitely a climbing destination in Korea. So much to do. With all these ice parks and natural ice falls, the country is bound to have a few ice climbing celebrities, and it does. It has two, actually. Woo Sun Shin, who is this year's overall World Cup champion in the female division, and Hee Young Park, who was the 2013 overall World Cup champion in the men's division. And these two, they're always in the top three, or at least top five. They're awesome. And their teammates, however, are also awesome, and they are often in the top 10 spots as well. Ice climbs are littered all over the country, and it takes an adventurous person to go seek them all out. You know, you might even stumble onto your own private icefall. As for a guidebook, to my knowledge, I looked and there is no commercially available ice climbing guidebook for the country. But every now and then, some of the larger outdoor magazines will put out a guidebook. So you got to be on the lookout for these. I have a personal copy from 2010 that was published by Chosun Media. So if you give me an email or leave a comment at the end of my show notes, I'd love to share whatever information I have with you. Okay, then somewhere in between the limbo between ice climbing and rock climbing, there is another activity called dry tooling. For those of you who are not familiar with the term, dry tooling is the art of climbing rock features with ice climbing tools, like crampons and ice axes. It's an activity that grew out of alpine climbing, as climbers often would have to transition from ice to rock and back to ice again so that they could reach, you know, the top of these super big mountains. But this activity has been gaining much popularity worldwide on its own. It's kind of like bouldering that way. And it's been helped along by the Ice Climbing World Cup events, because at the World Cup events, climbers have to do a lot of dry tooling. They have to climb on rock-like features, and they have to climb on ice. With Korean ice climbers doing so well in these mixed climbing events, and mixed climbing is dry tooling plus ice climbing. So with Koreans doing so well in these mixed climbing events, the dry tooling has just become more popular. And actually, apparently, one of the hardest dry tooling routes in the world, called Black Eagle, is in Korea. The first ascensionist, Young Hae Kwon, he rated it D13, but a few holds broke, and now he's rated it D14+. And another, the hardest confirmed dry tooling route, actually is D14+. Now, Young Hae Kwon, he knows his stuff. He's climbed all the hardest dry tooling routes in the world, and I think he did it all in one trip. So he knows what he's talking about. And the location of this climb, location of Black Eagle, is at Jobi Mountain, which is also a rock climbing area. In the show notes, I've included a link to the YouTube video of him doing the route, so you can check that out as well. There are very few dry tooling specific venues, since the activity is often done at rock climbing crags. But normally a dry tooling specific area would be what normal climbers call a choss pile, which in layman terms translates into loose, chunky rock that you can't really climb on safely, but it's perfect for sharp ice tools. So if you're handy with ice axes or axes and other sharp pointy tools, this might be the activity for you. So there's the summary of rock climbing and ice climbing and their hybrid spin-offs in Korea. But before we finish here, I'd like to introduce our listeners who have recently come to Korea or who are thinking about coming to Korea, the great resources that are available for you so that you can get started. If the mantra you save the best for last is right, then KOTR and KOTRI deserve a spot at the end of this podcast. KOTR, which is an acronym for Korea on the Rocks, is a website founded by Eric Bush in 2004. The website address is in the show notes, but it's here. It's www.koreaontherocks.com. The website serves as an online climbing guide with information on many, many, if not all, the climbing areas in Korea. And these were submitted by community members. Also, they have a forum section on the website, which is a great way to meet people and join people for climbs. I've often heard climbers who have come to Korea say how impressed they are with the climbing community here. They're impressed on how the community is connected and how supportive it is. And that's directly due to KOTR. Eric's contribution to climbing in Korea is enormous. And seriously, my hat is off to him for having the initiative that has helped so many people, you know, find a new life or find a new thing to do in Korea. And I truly hope to be able to do as much as his website has had and what he's done for climbers. Additionally, branching off KOTR is Korea on the Rocks Initiative. This was started by Brian Helensky. The original aim of the organization was to restore and maintain Korea's rock climbing areas, primarily through working with landowners for access and rebolting. I think I got that off the webpage. According to the webpage, which is at www.kotri.org, they conduct initiatives to protect, preserve, and maintain South Korean crags. So these guys, they do very good work. They provide climbers with the opportunity to contribute and become part of the South Korean climbing community. The organization has generated lots of success, and they've actually had corporate sponsors such as Adidas in the past, and I believe they're sponsored by Mammut now. They also host the popular Real Rock Tour, which showcases top climbing films. They're doing a bunch of good karma things, and their page is a must-see. Get involved, and you will be very welcomed and get tons of karma. So here we are at the end of our second podcast, and I feel like there's still so much to talk about. I haven't really dug in deep yet, but I'm going to save that for another time. I'm going to save that for another podcast. Like I said, this is just the Introducing Korea's Outdoor Adventure series, so it's just an introduction, get you kind of stoked, kind of get you amped, kind of let you know what is out there. I'll release part three of the series in about a month's time, a little later than normal, because I'll be going to the Philippines to participate in the Pan-Asian Jiu-Jitsu Tournament. Wish me luck. Anyways, in part three, we'll be talking about biking, specifically mountain biking. So check the webpage for updates at www.iguykorea.com/podcast.html. But now, nature's calling, and I'm not talking about the bathroom. The sun is about to go down. The light is getting soft. I can kind of see it through my tiny window here. It's got that, like, twilight, soft light. The weather is perfect and people are rushing to go home. That means there will be nobody on the trails and I'm going to go for a ride. So my fellow outdoor adventurers, have fun wherever you go and whatever you do. Remember to love and respect the earth. It's the only one we got. Go out there, enjoy everything it has to offer because it's free and it's priceless. Go out and play. I'm out of here. Bye-bye.